math. The Caribs did not kill off the Arawaks like we were taught in primary school. The Caribs and the Arawaks managed to live side by side for centuries before Columbus showed up. This is today's math. Today's lesson on how to build a village like a fortress, how your descendants survive despite every attempt to kill you. In the east, there is a town called Sangre Grande, Big Blood. And if the Spaniards, still mad they got so much blood of the Moors in them, named that town for a slaughter they suffered at the hands of braves, see how etymology teaches us things? Then irony is defined by how much white men's blood costs when measured against the blood of those they have conquered. Today's math is how to weave a basket that might hold water. Today's math is a history counted in barrels of oil. After centuries of sending the Indios to find gold for Queen Isabella and chopping off their hands if they returned without any. And irony is the question of gold's etymology. How far removed from God is its brilliant shine? Almost 400 years later before oil is discovered in Trinidad, and then 50 years later before oil drums are cut and pounded to invent the steel pan. Gold, for a music that when played well by the sons of slaves, sounds like the peal of God's laughter itself. Irony is the etymology of iron. And if, as the old people say, thief from thief makes God laugh, then today's math is also about the Indians' tassa drums. The ones from India, where Columbus was actually headed when the fucker got lost, and then straight shook by the impending mutiny about to take place on his ship. And legend says that at Columbus's darkest hour, he sends a bird from the ship, which brings back a branch in its beak. And mustn't he have fancied himself Noah then? An old Jew ordained by God to live when everyone around him died? When beset all round by terror, didn't the architects of the world's most vicious inquisition, if you don't count slavery itself, but we'll get to that soon enough, which slaughtered thousands of Jews, then turn to the lesson of a Jew? Today's math is the etymology of jewelry, of a search for gold that yielded music and a gazillion dead brown people. Big Blood, the sign reads, you are entering Sangre Grande. And if you're lucky enough to be a boy who gets taken through the bush there with his grandfather and to see for the first time the golden cocoa pods smelling rich as dirt itself, cocoa the English eventually exported back to England so they could turn around and sell us chocolate, that is, after their pirates' 18th century punking of Don Jose Maria Chacon, who, so shook at the sight of the English armada off the coast of Trinidad, burned his own ships in the harbor, then you will wake up one morning, a man who understands the laughter of God, and why the only place for it to come from was the deep, wailing belly of a steel drum, and why these sons of slaves sometimes tuned their pans in secret so they could keep that holy guffaw to themselves. You will understand why Trinidadians lament that more pans are now made in Sweden than in Trinidad itself. You will recognize today's man in the shiny chrome instrument being sold back to its inventor. Irony is when slaves become the fathers of unerasable legacy despite their master's fiercest motives. Irony is the greatest arranger of our time, Jit Samaru, succumbing to Alzheimer's and locking forever in his brain thousands of pages of sheet music. Irony is that he is a descendant of Indians, from India, where Columbus was headed, remember, and therefore, at least etymologically, the hoarder of all that gold. Spain, well, they lost a lot of land to American pirates, who, irony tells us, have their time coming soon enough. God is laughing in the music of the sons of slaves, and we can see it from conquered continent to conquered continent. Today's math is about the perfection of circles. The steel pan, the turntable, what goes around and comes around. Today's math is how to hoard gold, how, wherever cities are built in grids, those who build their villages at the center of circles like a fortress survive every bloodletting. All their descendants live to hear God laugh. Last year, an entirely black penguin was discovered in Antarctica. The Reuters News report, this has happened before, there's about a 1 in 250,000 D DNA chance that you can have an all-black and all-white penguin. The Reuters News report got really crazy. So the epigraph of this poem is from the Reuters News report, and then the poem. An all-black penguin has been discovered in Antarctica. It seems to be assimilating nicely. It has even found a black and white mate. The all-black penguin seems unafraid to defy its surroundings. The all-black penguin is healthy. Look at the size of those legs, said one scientist. It's an absolute monster. The all-black penguin speaks. 17 facts you did not know about me. 1. I was born here, raised here, met my mate and warmed my eggs here. 2. Fully 10 seasons passed before you noticed me. Don't make up theories now, Johnny Come Lately. 3. Penguins are colorblind. 4. Fuck your bell curve, motherfucker. I know that's not a fact, it's an imperative. 5. Penguins deliberately don't read, so we wouldn't have to learn words like discriminate, like mutate. 6. We pray every day. It's a simple chant. Evolve, evolve, evolve. 7. Don't you feel it getting warmer? Don't you see the ice melting? 8. I know the word rhetorical, bitch. 9. I'm actually the same size as all the other penguins. 10. You suffer from ocular necrophobia, the condition in which all black things look really large and scary. Yes, I know that's a fact about you, motherfucker. 11. I hate you. 12. I don't believe in the same God as you. 13. Evolve, evolve, evolve. 14. There are 2 other all blacks. We do not know each other. I'm prettier than you. 16. I'm making up a song about you. It's called Albino Motherfucker. 17. There are a couple all white penguins here. We're cool. They hate you too. My mother's afro was a magic orb of goodness. Afro sheen leaked onto its ends and became emerald in the sun. It was 1975 and my mother told me every day that I was black, taught me how to comb my own round globe of halo, how to hold the pick at its shoulder where the fist became the badass comb's wrist. In 1975, my mother took me to the tailor for my first suit, and it was super bad. Light blue with lapels like wings. It was sure enough made from something like polyester, but the trousers bloomed outward from the knees, so at the hems, my shoes were barely visible. The shoes? Chocolate brown Clarks with a rounded toe. I was aware for the first time that I was spectacular, though I wasn't yet sure what it meant to be black in the whole world. Where I was, I knew the light blue suit meant I was ordained in the boogie. I was allowed, even obliged, to funk. Something about clothes meant this, permission and responsibility. Something about being fresh was suddenly in play. When my aunt dragged me from class to the barber, my mother at work, my head shaven, I knew for the first time that my body would never be completely mine. I don't know how else to say now what the 7-year-old me came to know in the bottom of my stomach. If I had all the rage I eventually built into a citadel, had I the words I'd have recognized black. My mother came home, saw my head and became a bonfire. My aunt, disgusted, said she had to. My head was full of woolly stuff. And this is when I knew I was black for real. This is when I knew black was a city whose walls were constantly under siege. This is when I knew what hymns were meant for, that they were songs of anoint for the body that was constantly at war. And then my mother rose up saying, "Of course it's woolly. I have lain only with black men, men whose skin was the darkest black, men whose hair was the roughest wire, and they were beautiful, and my child's hair is this way because I have never, like you, lain with anyone light skin or even remotely Chinese, and my child is beautiful, woolly, black." And I knew I'd always be fighting, and I knew that I would win.